Welcome to Comics.
Episode 220. This week, we talk about
The Search.
Visit us at welcometocomics.com. Listen to past episodes. See what we're reading next. Send us a message. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. This episode is supported by listeners like you. Go to patreon.com/welcometocomics. And now,
the cast begins.
I'm just catching up on, like, the latest E3 news. The Last Guardian looks really cool.
Which one's that one?
It's the Sony one with, like, the kid and the wolf.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know. For me, it seems like E3 is turning into EA.
Yeah.
Like, they go in and they dominate it.
Especially this year, apparently they had like a million big announcements, more than anyone else.
Yeah, they really, really did. And there's one I really want to talk about with David. We might not do it as part of the show, but it was a big part of their thing. But like the Star Wars Battlefront, all of their like sports video games, there's new Need for Speed. What else was there? New Mirror's Edge. There's like other stuff too, I don't remember what.
New Final Fantasy.
Yeah, new Final Fantasy.
Ooh, new Metal Gear. But I think we knew that had been previously announced.
Yeah.
And then Fallout 4 had been announced about
a month ago.
Yeah.
The big thing for me for E3 was that the Xbox One is now gonna be backwards compatible.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they announced that. Apparently, it's just a software push. They're just going to push it out to all of them. And all the Xbox Ones are now. It's nice, but I'm kind of pissed. Because when they released the Xbox One and said it wasn't going to be reverse compatible, I went out and I sold my old Xbox and bought a newer bottle Xbox 360.
Oh.
So that I could play my older games for longer. Because I had an original Xbox 360. Like, that never red ringed. Like, I got one of the rare bug-free Gen 1 360s.
Damn.
And I'd been using it for years and years and years, and I was like, okay, if I still want to have a 360 that's running another 5 or 6 years from now, this thing feels like a time bomb. So.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go buy a newer one. So I went out and bought a newer one, but now I'm pissed because for like $50 more than what I paid, I could have gotten an Xbox One. Now.
This is actually how I ended up with a PS3. And it's that, so Grant had an Xbox, and I had wanted to borrow it, but his roommate Lucas had been using it, and he was like, oh, it's not working right. Well, he had red-ringed it, because what he kept doing was leaving it on for, like literally days at a time. And it was a Gen 1 Xbox, and with a lot of poking, prodding, and other such, I figured out it was the solder under the GPU needed to be reflowed. But I wasn't willing to, like, set off my smoke alarm to deal with it. Because you can, like, broil it, basically, in your oven to fix it.
Yeah, I've heard that. You just put it in your oven for, like, a couple minutes.
It's actually a really shitty way to do it, and there is a good way, but it involves, like, an air compressor, like an electric griddle, the kind that you would make pancakes on.
Okay.
And, like a fairly complicated setup and a lot of smoke. Because what you do is you set up the motherboard over a griddle that you set to a certain temperature, and then you use an air compressor to force solder under the GPU. Yeah.
Yeah, that would work. That does sound like a huge pain in the ass, though.
Yeah, so, and the thing is, I don't have a griddle or an air compressor or, like, the special attachments you need to do this, so it would have cost me as much to get a new Xbox.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, I'll get an Xbone. And then I looked at the list, and I was like, well, it's not backwards compatible. There's nothing I really want here.
Yeah.
And then I looked at the PS4 and PS3, and I don't think the PS4 is going to be backwards compatible for, like, another year or two, because the way the PS3 does it is through emulation.
Yeah.
But a high-end PC cannot emulate a PS3 right now. Which means a PS4 can't.
They're going to need to push out a new generation of more powerful PS4s.
Yeah, so the thing they're doing is they have a game. It's basically like their Netflix for games in beta right now, and they're adding more and more games that are being like basically retooled rather than emulated, and they're streamed. But apparently the service is incredibly shitty and fairly limited, so I was like, well, there's like 50 titles on the PS3 that I can think of off the top of my head that I want to play.
See, and that kind of thing also bugs me in the, like, I already paid for it way, you know? Like, I bought this for, like, that would bug me because it'd be like, I bought this for PS3, and then I bought a PS4, and now you're asking me to basically pay for the game again.
Yeah, that's kind of what gets me, too, about it. So, yeah, I also figure, Grant's been kind of fiddling with the idea of getting a PS4 for months, and he was unhappy with the PS3. He's like, you should just get a 4, and I'm like, you can get that. And he might, because he does that. When he wants something, he just buys it. So
now you can prod him for an Xbox One, because
thing is, like, the more and more I look at the games library, the more I realize that there are, like, no Xbox exclusives that I really care about, and that's really what matters. They're on PC.
Yeah. Well, and what I've noticed is the big title games for Xbox are mostly first-person shooters, and I would rather play those on PC anyway. Mm-hmm. So, like, as much as I genuinely enjoy playing the Halo franchise just because I think it's fun, I don't think it's grand science fiction storytelling or anything like that. I just think it's fun. I really wish I could buy Halo 5 for my PC. Like, I would way rather do that, because I just, no, controller, fuck this.
Yeah. The people I've met who, like, I recommend Mass Effect to, and they're like, oh, I tried it and really hated it, have played it on an Xbox, and it's like, no, you can't play a shooter that requires precision on a console and be, like, happy with that. It just, like, the reason bro games like Call of Duty work is, you don't need to be super precise. It's more about, like, just kind of reacting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Reacting, knowing the map, being in the right place at the right time. Yeah. Yeah, but with Mass Effect, there's no such thing as being in the right place. Also, it's not, like, there's the multiplayer part of it, too. Like, playing through single-player mode, you can always tweak the difficulty, but as soon as you get in the multiplayer, there are some people who are just really fucking good at playing shooters with a controller. And it just obliterates your experience. And I know there's the same, like, different level of class with a keyboard and mouse, too. But with a keyboard and mouse, I at least feel like I can compete.
Yeah.
I can keep up.
I'm not fighting the controls. It's more like you're fighting yourself and your ability to, like, pay attention and then react.
Yeah.
But it's like, if you want to react with a controller, I find precision to be really difficult with a joystick, and they're not designed to be precise.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've been playing, like, a bunch of Bayonetta. Have you played that game at all?
No, I have not played Bayonetta.
It is the most amazing cheesecake you've ever seen in your life.
Oh, well, that appeals to me.
It is Bayonetta. It is so over-the-top, like, excellent.
What console is that for?
It's on the 360.
360? All right.
Actually, I still have the 360 copy, and our 360's trash, so if you just want it, can give it to you.
Cheesecake.
It is not just cheesecake, it is the best cheesecake.
Wonderful.
Like, you walk away from every cutscene, like, both laughing and saying Bayonetta is the baddest badass ever.
Awesome. David, I'm so excited that you got your new computer just in time for Knights of the Fallen Empire.
You mean just in time for everything that's being previewed at E3 this weekend?
Yeah, Jen and I were just talking about E3, but I am psyched for SWTOR's expansion. It looks fucking sick.
Yeah, me too. I'm psyched for that. I'm psyched for Doom. I have a bunch of games on that I bought. Well, I bought three games on the Steam sale so far.
Yeah. What'd you get?
I bought Arkham Asylum, Arkham Origins, and Arkham City.
Batman!
Except now I feel like, I really feel like I should have a controller.
Oh, wow.
To go with my, my computer.
Do you have a wired Xbox controller?
I don't have a hardwired one. I have one of the ones that has a wire you plug in to charge it.
Oh, I don't know if that works or not.
So Brandon was telling me that, my cousin Brandon was telling me, that what he uses, he has this little, like, wireless dongle.
Oh, or yeah, I got the same thing.
So that it's like a $10 thing from Amazon.
Yep.
So I'm gonna pick that up.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend that. I've been using that. The only thing with mine is you kind of have to sit like, you know how my couch is like the four cushions? You have to sit the two cushions closer to the computer in order for it to work well.
Well, I mean, I'll be playing on the laptop.
Yeah, so if it's on your laptop, it's fine. I would see if you can find one that's straight up a dongle, because mine has like a cable and like a thing, and like so you can set it away from the computer if you want to, like out into the room. But yeah. If they have a dongle one, totally grab the dongle one.
All right. Yeah, I feel like it would be nice to have, because feels kind of wonky playing Batman with the keyboard. It's not that bad, actually, because it's like you kind of just click to make Batman punch.
Yeah.
Probably get used to it, but I imagine in the future there will be instances where I would like to have a actual, you know, controller, so.
It is very nice to have a controller for your PC.
Yeah, it's just on my list of things to get now that I have this awesome gaming laptop.
Oh, I will say, if you're playing Xbox games, the actual Microsoft brand Xbox controllers seem to be much better than the third-party ones. I don't know why, but like they just seem more durable and they don't crap out as easily.
Yeah.
I was told that they no longer manufacture wired controllers.
They do, or they sell them still on Amazon. And GameStop's still carry them for like $20.
Yeah, there's always, you can get a used one at GameStop too.
Oh yeah, I just looked on Amazon. I just googled it real quick on Amazon, and it's like $27.
Nice.
For a wired one.
That's not too
bad. And I can get like a gold one or oh, not available. Oh well. I
guess I'm just lying.
There's a gold one and a camo one. Yeah, it's Chrome series the gold one.
Yeah. Bling it the fuck out. I got one of those for my wife and she loves it.
But yeah, I'll probably just buy this instead of the dongle then, cuz it's kind of I don't want to have to like charge my controller every once in a while.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's my understanding that if you have the cable that plugs into the wireless one, you can't actually play a game with it.
No, yeah, you can't. I've tried it.
And so that would be like annoying because it's like, okay, your battery's dead. You want to play a game, but you have to wait for your controller to charge. Seems kind of annoying.
Yes.
And I think with a controller, like, I would feel comfortable buying like fighting games and stuff, because the only Xbox 360 game I still have is the DC fighting game that we read the comic about. Injustice, yeah, that's the only 360 game I still actually have. Well, yeah, the comic's great, but the game is actually really fun.
Yeah, it is.
So, and I have like all the DLC, I have all the DLC on it, but my controller's not even plugged, or my Xbox isn't even plugged into the TV.
Yeah.
So it's just collecting dust. And mine's so old that it's like I can't really turn it into GameStop. Mine's like a first gen 360, you know. It has like a 10 gig hard drive or something stupid like that. So it's like I can't even give it away.
No, there's always Craigslist for like $50, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Some kid will want to get it.
Yeah.
So did you read up on Knights of the Fallen Empire?
Not a whole lot. I mostly just I watched the trailer a couple times and I asked you what's up with that.
So let me walk you through it, because I think it's fucking awesome. And Jen, I know you don't play SWTOR, but this is relevant for anybody who plays an MMO. So right now SWTOR is 60 levels, and it's about the Cold War that follows the Great War between the Sith Empire and the Old Galactic Republic. And so they were at war, and then they signed a peace treaty, and now there's like a Cold War between them. And right now, the game 1 to 60 is in that Cold War, and it's a lot of like taking pot shots at each other. So for this expansion, what they're going to do is when you get to level 60, which is the current cap, this cap goes to level 65. When you enter this content, it's like your character just came out of frozen carbonite for a couple years. And when you come out, the war is over. Both sides lost. Both the Galactic Republic and the Empire destroyed themselves in the struggle. And it's just you out there either trying to rebuild a Sith Empire or rebuild like a Jedi Order or Republic. And the cool thing about this is that that puts you in this sort of lawless area. So they're making it really, really story focused. So instead of you traveling to quest hubs like you do in every MMO that exists, you start a chapter of story. And as you progress through the chapter, you get chunks of XP that level you up. But the thing is, each chapter is story-driven, and you make BioWare-style choices. So now they're saying, like, every follower that you've had, every companion, you can betray them, kill them, murder them, abandon them, promote them, and completely reshape your ship's crew, and you can get new followers, there's new planets, all that kind of cool stuff. But basically, like, if you were playing a light side Sith, you can roll that into making, like, a Sith Order. Like a Sith Jedi Order thing. It's so weird. But it looks really fucking cool because it's, like, I hadn't thought about it until they were talking about it for this expansion at their E3 thing. But, like, quest hubs suck. Like, that's the thing people hated about this game for so long, was that you would go to a quest hub and it would be fake story-driven where you go and talk to people, but it's really just a go-kill-10-rabbits quest. Go get 10... beholder eyes for me. Like, that's all the quests were, but it faked it off as being this story thing, but you really, really wasn't. And, like, yeah, that's why it sucked for quite a while.
But that's what I really liked about the XP boost they did, because you could just only do the storyline quests.
Yeah.
And you would level up at the appropriate rate. The only issue is that you would not necessarily have the right gear.
Mm-hmm. But which they've kind of gotten around, it's kind of negligible to me. Now they've boosted the bonuses for those quest rewards such that you can gear up quickly enough. You just have to go back to your fleet often enough to get new gear, but it's a lot better now. Yeah. But like, yeah, the success of that was so good, like tons of people resubbed to do the epic boost. Like I resubbed to get the 12x boost.
Yeah, I did too.
And it's a fun game that way. It's really, really fun that way. And so they're like, why don't we try and make a whole game expansion like that? But they couldn't do that within the confines of the story as it is right now. So they were just like, fuck it. We're going to make an expansion that's basically like a whole different world when you play through it.
Which so question.
Is awesome.
I don't know if they release the information, but if it's... I mean, it's an MMO, so if they're doing this with the story, how does that affect your interaction with lower-level people if you're, like, 2 years in the future?
I don't know either, and I'm thinking, like, well, can you run old operations? Can you run old dungeons? Like, how does that work? I really don't know. I don't know if it removes you from that content or what. Actually, that's a really good question.
I look forward to finding out, because I think however they manage that could be really relevant to MMOs in general and being able to just diverge from what's already established.
Because when they started talking about it, like, in terms of quest hubs, like, that's when I realized why I was so burnt out on WoW. Like, I want to level up some of these classes and play in-game stuff with them, but I don't want to, like, go through this quest hub's random bullshit at Shadow Moon. Like, go, you know, squeeze 3 frogs into a jar and then bring them back to What's-Her-Face. Like... Like, I just don't want to do that for the 6th time. I just don't. But if it were story-driven, class by class, every class would feel different as you leveled it up through Draenor. Like, that idea appeals to me. That, like, that infinite replayability. And, like, because of the 12x boost in SWTOR, I was telling David earlier today, like, I've got a level 40 waiting for you to hop back on your bounty hunter. And he was like, oh, I'm sorry for making you wait. And I was like, no, I got to level up an Inquisitor, which has been so much fun.
That's the problem, is the reason I haven't finished leveling up my bounty hunter is because I started leveling up a smuggler and an inquisitor, and they're both in the mid-20s now, after like 6 hours of gameplay, but there's still a bunch more story left to do, and you know, and I got to a part in the story with my bounty hunter that I'm like into to the story again, because it feels like this is a big turning point in his story. So
I will go with you, and I will shoot motherfuckers out of the sky for you. Marksman sniper.
Awesome.
I should resub and finish leveling up my smuggler that I abandoned so long ago.
What level is?
She's almost level 60. She's like 55 or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
well, 55 was the old level cap.
Oh, what? Okay, then it was 50. I was like five below.
Yeah, so. It was 55 was the old level cap, and then they boosted it up to 60.
I should do that.
Actually, it might have been 50, then 50. I don't know. I think it was 50 originally, and then 55 with Rise of the Hutt Cartel.
That sounds about right.
60 for Shadow of Revan, and now 65.
I feel like she was 50, but...
Either way, if you haven't finished the story, I mean...
It will be worth doing.
Yeah. I've got a Sith Marauder who can help you out. He's a baller.
Nice.
Anyway, yeah. Do you guys want to talk about Steam Sale, or do you want to just ignore how small our walls have gotten and talk about... Okay.
Yes, okay. So my friend was over a couple days ago, and he's like, oh, Steam Sale, and I didn't even realize it was happening, because at this point, I've bought everything on Steam that I want, basically.
Yeah.
And then he pointed me out to this dating sim. And, I can't remember that. It's something Hatoru Boyfriend? The second word is boyfriend.
Had to be Japanese.
And in it, you're the only, you've just transferred to a new high school, because this is a Japanese dating sim, and you're a unique person in that you're the only human in a school full of pigeons. And the people you court are pigeons.
Fucking Japan.
And it was like $3.50 for the collector's edition, so I was just like, yes. It comes with like a soundtrack and... like wallpapers and stuff. It's called Hatoful Boyfriend. Hatoful. And it's a pigeon dating sim, but I think you're a human.
Alright, just made a note of it.
Well, as we were talking about SWTOR, I purchased Far Cry Blood Dragon for $3.75.
Nice. Yes. That game is so amazingly absurd.
Oh, well, I know it's basically a skin for Far Cry, right? And so, I mean, it's fine with me because it's like super 80s.
But it's like,
it's been on my wish list for a long time.
Yeah. All I've bought so far is Long Live the Queen, which is a simulator where you try not to die as a monarch.
there are 15 games on my wish list that are on sale right now.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh,
and I'm trying to not buy any of them. But so many of them are like $3.
It's hard not to buy those, even if you know you're not going to play in them much. I mean, three fucking bucks.
You guys played XCOM, right?
I bought it a long time ago.
I played XCOM like 2 days ago.
So, I have like zero patience for tactics games because they're too slow for me, but there is one that's out right now called Massive Chalice that Grant just finished playing, and it looks really good because it's basically like the kingdom's under attack and a giant chalice comes down from the sky and says it will save your kingdom in 300 years, but you gotta hold out till then. So you have to start like all these dynasties. So it's like Breeding Sim plus XCOM.
See, here's the thing with XCOM, though. I don't really like tactics games, but I like XCOM because it has incredibly strong nostalgia value for me, because the original XCOM UFO Defense was one of the first PC games I ever played. And so I have super strong nostalgia for the XCOM property. Same thing with Descent. Do you guys remember Descent?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was like a shooter.
I bought a joystick just for that game.
Where you're in like a little spaceship, right?
Yeah.
And it's like a 360 degree, three dimensional shooter. And so I have Descent.
Oh, and I forgot for EA, fucking new Mass Effect.
I didn't
look at the trailer. I just saw new Mass Effect.
I will play it, and I think it will be excellent. But I really love Shepard's story, and I assume this won't be it.
Yeah.
No. It's going to be like the prequel thing, right?
Oh, I don't know. Is it prequel?
I heard people saying, speculatively, that it would be like that one guy who was the hero of Earth way like 100 years before Shepard. But I didn't actually read the announcement from EA, so maybe it's not.
Okay, so it's a prequel then?
You know, it's really hard to tell. They didn't give any information. The speculation was that it would be a prequel, but it seems like it could be either based on the description.
Huh. Sorry, which game are you guys talking about?
There's a new Mass Effect coming out as well. Ah. Anyway, you were talking about Descent.
Oh, yeah, I was just saying that I put money into the Kickstarter for the new one.
Oh.
Which I'm kind of excited for, but kind of not, because it seems to be a multiplayer-only game.
Hmm.
But we'll see.
Well, I still have that joystick that I bought just to play the original, and it still works. It's a USB 1.1 joystick, but it still works. So I'll play it with you.
Okay.
Assuming it's not like $30 or something stupid. I'll play it with you. Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that $30 would be stupid for somebody's hard work, but you know what I mean.
Right.
Anyway, you guys ready to talk about this week's comic?
This week's comic.
All right. This week we read The Search by Jean Luen Yang and Guri Hiru. Guri Hiru. I said it right that time, for sure.
That's correct.
Yeah. So same creative team that did last week, same creative team that's going to do next week. And actually, I just found out there's another three-part graphic novel thing coming out in September, I think it was. Smoke and Fire or something like that. I don't know. But it's about Zuko and Ozai and all that Zuko-y kind of stuff. Anyway, that's future. Right now, The Search. Oh my god, we finally found out what happens to Zuko's mom.
Yep. I found this comic to be very satisfying.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. I like this one better than the previous week's installment as well.
Me too. I have not a complaint about this comic. I thought it was just really excellent, and it answered all the questions I had from the show that I cared about in a way that I enjoyed.
I have one complaint, and that's not enough Toph. but at the same time, I get it. I feel like maybe that would have been felt a little bit forced, because there weren't really any instances where Toph would have been needed in progressing the story. So yeah. As a fan of Toph, I would have loved to have seen her around, but, you know, the story was great even without Toph.
Yeah, I think they were trying to keep it tight. Because the huge theme of this story is family and, like, especially like the brother sister interactions, there's a lot of contrast between Sokka and Katara and Azula and Zuko in this,
for sure,
in this comic. There's tons of contrast between them. And then the brother sister that they find in the Valley of the, what was it called?
Forgetful Valley?
Forgotten Valley, yeah. Like, there's that brother, like, there's a huge brother sister theme that runs through this, and how the brother sister thing, like, reacts to parents. There's the family theme is so deep in here, and Toph kind of abandoned her family and kind of hates her family, and it would add a thing with the dynamic like Zuko and Ozai, but that wasn't the driving theme here. The driving theme here was that brother-sister relationship of the family.
Right.
Which is important, because like in the beginning it's set up like Zuko obviously feels some need to repair his family. Or not, you know, maybe I'm wrong.
I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, I forget who said it to him, but somebody said that, you know, leading, like being a leader, they compared leading the nation to being part of a family.
Yeah, that was Confucius at the beginning.
The Earth Kingdom Professor Man.
Who looks right, insanely right. Like Confucius. And
yes.
And that is a Confucian saying, right? Like, the nation is a large family and the family is a small nation.
Right. And so that had a huge impact on Zuko, obviously, because he wasn't really paying attention Or it wasn't, I think he was trying to pay attention during the lecture.
I think he was one of the few people who was.
Like, Sokka and Aang were distracting him. But he really seemed, that seemed to really resonate with him. Because he's having trouble, he's having issues being the Fire Lord. And at the same time, he's having issues. His family is broken, right?
Yeah.
His mom's missing. His sister's in the nut house, and his dad's in jail. And those two last things are kind of his fault, not necessarily directly. They're fallout from the larger conflict of the show, right?
They were both done by his hand, I would say.
Right, but I mean, like, Ozai put himself in the position.
Yeah.
To be where jail was.
Yeah, he wanted to be the Phoenix King, and that doesn't work out so well.
And then Azula is kind of sadistic and a psychopath.
Yeah, she's cracked and broken.
And actually, I feel like here we kind of see there is room for redemption for her. Is she going to be a good person? I don't know. Maybe she's going to be like, if I could compare it to another character in another franchise that I really like, she's kind of like Asajj Ventress in a little bit, in some ways. Like, she starts out as, like, chaotic evil, to pull in yet another franchise, being D&D.
She was the badass in control.
She's kind of, yeah, she's
of but the then, dark side.
But then she is kind of cast aside by her previous...
By her allies.
Yeah, her allies or her mentor, in Asajj Ventress's case, being Dooku and Palpatine indirectly. And so now she's kind of, she's still evil, definitely, but she's more willing to,
play to her own, like her own interests.
Right. So like, if you think back, there's the episodes of the Clone Wars where Ahsoka is, the whole Ahsoka and...
Ahsoka and Barriss and...
Barriss, Ophi, yeah. So, that kind of reminds me... this story we read here in the Search, especially Azula's story, reminds me of kind of Asajj Ventress's journey.
Yeah. Because, I mean, just like that. Like, Azula's very much out for herself here. I mean, she obviously knows that she can't return to power. She can escape, but there's no royal life for her anymore. And she definitely still has the, like, not, what's the word? She's definitely classicist against peons and commoners. She still sees herself as better than them just because she's royal.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, she realizes that she has to operate for herself. She has to do things the way Zuko wants to do them until she can get what she wants. There's no more calling the royal this and that, and she can't say that she's the daughter of the Fire Lord. She knows that those things don't work, but because she's crazy, she blames it all on her mother, who she also was fairly certain was dead, or didn't care up until now why, or where she had gone. But, like, she definitely, she wants, I believe her when she said that she wanted to find her mom too, genuinely.
Yeah.
For much, much more nefarious reasons. Wanted to murder the shit out of her.
I was actually a bit surprised because, I mean, you always get the sense Azula is a bit nutty, but this drove home that she actually hallucinates. I always kind of assumed that she was seeing something, I don't know, spiritual or something left to her by her mother that no one else could see, like an actual connection. But it's just manufactured in her head. It's her conscience, basically, yeah, as far as I can tell. Yeah, and it deepens a sense, like, from when she was a little child, there's always been something wrong with her in terms of, like, her moral compass is not just influenced by, like, her father, for instance. There's intrinsically something evil about her, and she has a really bad way to cope with right and wrong. She just bottles up the guilt and goes crazy.
Yeah.
I guess I don't know, like, I finally saw her as being actually crazy instead of being crazed by some other, like, outside influence.
Yeah, because, you know, in the show, she's only really nutty like this for, what, two episodes? Three? It's it, for the most part in the show, she's super tight and in control. And when it unravels really, really quickly. And so you don't really get the sense that it's a permanent change. That's a thing from within her that's come out. You get a sense that it might be a temporary thing. Like she just has lost control. And so she's lost it.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of sense from the show that she might be able to ravel it back up. And it here, it kind of still feels that way. Like there are times when she's in control, when her face looks sane. And then she'll start to think or talk about her mother, and it all kind of goes from there. But at least in this comic, you get the sense that what's wrong with her has always been wrong with her. She's just kept it bottled. And now it's out, and she can't put it back. And it's going to be out forever.
Did it make her more sympathetic to you? Because for me, I suddenly looked at her like, she's not evil, she's ill.
I mean, that's the thing, is how sympathetic can you be toward a murderous psychopath? Like, it's not her fault. You're right. Like, she's obviously got some kind of disease. Or disorder. I should say disorder. She has some kind of severe disorder. But, you want to blame her actions on the disorder, but the disorder is, like, part of her defining personality characteristics.
True, you know? But I also feel like this really highlighted that her perception of reality is not the same reality that, like, Aang and Zuko and Katara and Sokka live in. And when, like, you can only react to the reality you live in. So if she's seeing different things, if she's hearing her mom, like, tormenting her all the time, her reactions, I don't know. I don't think her cruelty is ever justified, but I think it's more pitiable now.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's sad.
Yeah. Like, well, go on.
Oh, no, sorry. You can go and finish your thought.
Like, sometimes it feels really good to see a bad guy, like, quash down and, like, get got. But now I don't ever want to see that happen to her. I want to see her recover. Right, I don't think if we ever see her defeated, there'd be any satisfaction in that. It would just feel sad.
Yeah. Yeah, she definitely is, I think, more redeemable than her father. Because her father is just, he's evil by birth, and he's evil nurturing evil nature. And you get the feeling that Azula's evil by nature, but not by nurture. Her mom tried left and right to make her a better person and just couldn't. Because her father was always such a strong influence on Azula. But because her mother was in her life, and was actually a pretty big chunk of her life, you get the sense that that's in her too. It's in there somewhere. The same way that there's a little bit of Ozai in Zuko. You know? And that comes out every once in a while. But it's, I don't know. It gets into that brother-sister relationship and the whole thing with family and parents, and I don't know.
I actually am not certain that her cruelty is nature. Because if you think about it, she's younger than Zuko
mm-hmm.
by a few years, I think. And, you know, the mom left when Zuko was really young. So Azula must have been quite young. So, I mean, children do dumb, destructive things. They'll, like, destroy a flower. There's a funny scene about her in the cartoon where the mom is, like, trying to feed turtle ducks some bread, and Azula's, like, just beaning them with the food. But that's something little kids do, I think, as they test boundaries. And it's supposed to show us, like, how Azula was mean and evil from the start, but at the same time, like, her mom left so young, and you get that scene where the mom says, well, if I am your mother, I'm sorry I didn't love you enough. And she starts crying. You kind of get the sense that maybe Azula just didn't have enough of that influence, that it left her life too early. And it, like, I don't know if the things that we see about her very early life are damning enough to paint her as actually evil. And I think they're supposed to be that way just because it's a cartoon and Zuko's the good guy and Azula's the bad one. But I also feel like Avatar, as a cartoon and a comic, leaves room for more complexity than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I just think she was born... I mean, psychopathy is something that you're born with. You know? Sometimes it's brought about by trauma, but usually it's something that you're born with. And I think Azula is on the psychosociopathic spectrum, and there's just a part of her that doesn't have empathy. Or only has empathy in extreme cases. And, like, just being cruel to animals is one of those universal signs. Like, that's why I'm not glad they went there. But you're right, little kids will kick flowers and, you know, they'll do that stuff because they need to know what destruction looks like. But most people, most kids don't have that impulse with animals and other living things the way that Azula has shown that she likes to do.
True.
Yeah. I don't know. It does. I go back and forth with her. But you're right. The nice thing about Avatar is that they have realized characters. Even though it's a kid's show, these are realized characters, right? Like, there is room for that complexity of... Azula's never going to be pure evil or pure good. And most characters in this show aren't going to be pure evil or pure good. Like, even Ursa, as much as she's canonized by her son, is not pure good. Ursa makes what a lot of people would say is the weak decision to put on a mask and forget her two children. Like, people would demonize her for doing that.
Yeah.
It's understandable from our point, but they would do it.
That's kind of the thing, too. I mean, she never gets to see them again, and trying to do so would simply put them in danger. If that's the case, I think that it's a fair argument one way or the other. Is it okay to try to forget them?
Yeah, she works in that gray area. With that and with the poison that she gives her, that she gives Ozai, and Ozai uses to kill his father.
I get that one, though, because it was in exchange for Zuko's life.
Yeah, but then you get an old, is it fair to trade one life for another? And also, you could argue that if Ozai hadn't had the poison, and if Ozai hadn't killed his father, Iroh was legitimately in line to be king. If Ozai hadn't done that, Iroh would have become the Fire Lord. And then maybe Iroh would have ended the war anyway. Like, you could make the argument that Ursa's decision to save Zuko was insanely selfish and cost, like, decades more suffering for a lot of the people in this world.
Absolutely.
But you can entirely empathize with why she does it.
Yeah. And I think there's also the question of, as a mother, is it more your duty to protect a million strangers or your one child? I mean,
yeah.
I'm not a mom. I would say a million strangers. Maybe I would be a terrible mom with that opinion, but I don't know. I think that a lot of people would say your own child, and I totally understand that.
Yeah. It's really easy it's really easy to say that the utilitarian decision is the right one, to always save the greater number of lives. It's really easy to say that from, like, a logical, philosophical point of view, but I'm sure if you're in that situation, it don't work like that. it doesn't.
Yeah.
But that I think is much more of a gray area than what we were talking about before, with her decision to, like, I think that's a personal decision on a huge level to forget her two other kids. I mean, she has to choose between, that's tough. She has to choose between the love of her children. And I'm sure even though she knows that Azula is a bit of a monster, it's still her daughter, and she's going to love her daughter at least a little bit in that way that only a mother can. And she has to choose between that love and the love of the woman she was going to marry before she got taken away. Like, that's tough. There's yeah. no, I mean, she could stay Ursa and go with Ikem. Ikem. Like, she could go with Ikem and not change her face, but then she's got to find somewhere real remote to live. Like, real remote.
I also want to get, like, pedantic nerd here and be like, well, the thing about Iroh is his turning point was when his son died.
Yeah.
So we don't know he was a good person before that.
You're right. Ursa would not have known yeah. in this instant. Ursa would not have known at this time what Iroh would have been like. As that is a hindsight's 2020 argument with yeah. Iroh. It totally is, and I acknowledge it. But
it is a super pedantic argument because Iroh is a good person.
You know Ozai is a exactly. You know Ozai is a bad dude, and Iroh, as much as Iroh was having fun conquering Ba Sing Se before his son died, he was still buying presents and sending them home to his nephews and nieces. Like,
yeah.
That's a good dude. Like, he's a general and he's doing what a general needs to do. And that's gray area morally, but he was sending home like gifts, which, I mean, I don't see Ozai sending home gifts like dolls.
Yeah. Although I think there was a scene like in the last comic, the last week, where Ozai talks about how he took a beach vacation with Zuko and had to save him from drowning.
Yeah.
And that seems like, that almost seemed like a warm fatherly moment, like almost.
Yeah. That's the thing with Ozai, you question all of the motives. I had to save him because he's my son and he's in line for the throne. I couldn't just let him die. I'm sure it was kind of thing.
But Azula was around. He could have just put Azula in line, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's no... He didn't have any compunction about doing it after he had already banished Zuko.
And it doesn't seem to be, like, patriarchal in the same way like the Northern Water Tribe is, where...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
So
Water Tribe more backward.
Who knows?
So
I think it comes down to the fact that Ozai is clearly an evil person, and Azula is in... She could kind of go either way.
Yeah.
I mean, what I saw when I was reading, especially towards the third issue of this, is that she... to me, it seemed like she didn't know how to react to the situation around her. Do you know what I mean? Like
it was just too much?
Right, and so she was reacting in the way that came naturally to her, which was to be a jerk to everybody else. But clearly,
doubt,
I think
be a dick.
I think we see in her that she in her reactions to the revelation that her mother is alive and stuff. That she runs away, right? And she lets Zuko keep the letter. You know, I think Aang's right that she could destroy it. She shoots fire, right? She
yeah.
could easily destroy the letter. It's just paper. And so she runs away because she's confused. And, you know, in her own, in her hallucinations and stuff, she's trying to, at least to me, it seems like she's trying to resolve her own conflicting emotions. So I personally feel that there is hope for Azula. I don't think she's going to come around and be BFFs with the Avatar gang, but, you know.
Yeah, I think she's worthy of redemption for sure, because there is still somebody alive who loves her and Ursa.
And Zuko, I think. I mean, yeah. like he in his conversations with Sokka, you know, what's his McCallit? Zuko comments how Sokka is nice to Katara, despite the fact that he gets snowballs in the face all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Sokka's response is that, well, she's his sister, and that's that. And I think Zuko wants to have that kind of relationship with Azula.
Yeah. He wants a normal family so much. But it's just not, it's not in the stars for him. It's just right. Not. No matter how much he wants to work for it, I don't think it is. And that's fine. And I think that's, like, that concept is mirrored in the spirit world, too. Like, we haven't even talked the Mother of Faces, who I fucking love her character design. She's amazing.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
Mother mm-hmm. of Faces. But one of my favorite moments in this comic was when the dude in the forest, the brother, when his mask gets blown off, and the Mother of Faces is like, oh, that's Ko's work. And it's like, Ko is my son. And he's been my son since time began, and since time began, he's been wayward and weird and out there, and I've always been like, you get the feeling that, like, the Mother of Faces is a little bit of ashamed of what Ko has become, but still loves him. And, like, Ko is such a good villain in the show, too. He's legitimately fucking terrifying. Like, even as an adult, he is terrifying. But the Mother of Faces loves him. And just sees him as this wayward, lost child that needs appreciation in his own way. And, like, that's exactly what Azula is.
Yeah, totally. Ursa loves Azula despite her numerous flaws. And you could say the same thing about Zuko. Zuko loves Azula despite her being Azula, right?
Despite Azula, Azula.
Yeah.
What about you guys? Did you guys have favorite moments in this comic?
I knew you were going to ask that question, so I was looking it up, and now I forgot what my favorite part was. So let me pull up my Dark Horse app and look at it again.
I will say my other favorite moment was Flower Ninja Stars. Because Flower Ninja Stars, that's the best use of waterbending I've ever seen.
That was pretty creative, yeah.
How about you, Jen?
I will say it's when Azula gets hit in the head with the boomerang. Mr. Yes. Boomerang. I'm sorry, Mr. Boomerang.
That was one of those moments where I was like, finally.
Yeah. He kept saying it would happen, and for once he was right.
So I could talk to Big Game.
Hey, he pulled it off. That's that's hardcore right there.
Plus, I also really loved all the tie-ins from the series. Those, like, loose, dangling, like, when Ozai says that Zuko's mother did treasonous things that night. It's like, yeah, it's true. Those were treasonous things. Made a potion to kill the Fire Lord. That's treasonous. You know? And, like, when she takes the portrait of her and Ozai off the wall and there's the four masks and it's the two that, the one that she wore for the play, the one that Ikem wore for the play, and the blue spirit mask is on the wall too. And you're like, I know where Zuko got that mask from now. And, like, the line that Zuko tells Aang later on when they're in the snow about how his father says that he was lucky to be born and his sister was born lucky. Like, all those little bits of tie-in, just, you realize, it does a really good job of not only tying it into the show for you, but it also does a really, really good job of making you look back on all those moments in the show and realize how all along so much of Zuko as a person was driven by this mother figure. Like, start to finish in the series, Zuko was driven by Ursa one way or another, and it just, the way those things get dropped in here just reinforces so many of the themes from the show too. It's a really good symbiotic relationship.
For sure.
Yep. Got a moment yet, Dave?
I can't remember where it was. I found one and then I totally blanked.
Oh, God.
Talking. I don't know. I really love this comic. Like I said, I like this one a lot better than The Promise.
Hmm.
Because I think the reason I like this one so much is because it certainly tied up loose ends in the show.
Yeah.
And that was certainly the purpose of the search. I think the promise was trying to do something different. It was showing us the way the world moved in the subsequent, in the times following the end of the war.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, if you love this comic so much, David, why don't you rate it?
Fine.
I think this is like the fourth week in a row I've told you to rate something first. It's just so easy to transition into you.
Thanks. I'm going to give this... Man, like Jen, I can't really think of anything wrong with it. And so I feel like maybe this is a little bit of fanboy creeping in, but I'm going to give this 5.
Yeah.
I love this comic from start to finish. I was bad in that, you know, this weekend was very busy for me, so I didn't actually read this comic until this morning. But I read all of it while I was supposed to be working on my phone. not working on my phone. I mean, I read it on my phone thanks to the excellent Dark Horse iOS app. But yeah, this is... I can't think of anything bad, and I think maybe it's hard for me to pick a single scene that I really loved, because I loved this whole thing. And I know that seems like a bit of a cop-out, but... you know, I just... But when you watch the show, by the time it ends, you really are rooting for Zuko. And this... I feel like this comic gives him what he deserves. And usually when somebody gets what they deserve, that
means... Got his comeuppance.
Yeah, but this is not what I... That's not what I mean in this. Like, Zuko really redeemed himself in the course of the show. And here we see him, we see something wonderful happen for him. And it's a really good, happy ending.
Yeah.
So 5.
I am going to give it a 4.5. I'm going back and forth in my head about whether I like this one more or The Promise more. I feel like this one was a better encapsulated story, and I really, really love how strong the themes are about faces and masks and the way that we disguise ourselves and the way we take our masks off with family, and sometimes some people don't, and how that creates internal conflict within the family. Like, I love so much of what's in here. And then I love the way that all of that is made literal with the Mother of Faces and with Ko. And I like so much of the themes here. But in The Promise, I really, really love the heavier stuff about colonization and cultural appropriation. I feel like that dealt with bigger and more difficult ideas and did it in a way that was very uniquely Avatar. And this feels, it doesn't feel like it has that. And that's what I like the most about Avatar. That said, I will acknowledge that I think this is a better story.
Well, I think this is the story we read in The Promise is more of a story of the world in which Avatar exists, and this story in The Search is a very personal story for Zuko. Yeah.
It's a story of a specific family.
Like, and the whole
the lens is through which you can see that family.
The whole bit with, you know, the woman from the water tribe and her brother.
Yeah.
That seemed... That was like something for Aang to do while Zuko was getting his
Aang do spirit things.
Well, while Zuko's story was progressing, and that sounds like a little bit of a put down, but I thought that Aang's what Aang was doing was valid too.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the end of the TV show, Aang is a realized character, and Zuko's getting there. Zuko's still right. Not fully realized by the time the show is over. He's not a complete whole person yet. And these comics are great because they show you him getting there.
Well, so I think this
In this comic, it's like, okay, Aang's a realized character. What am I going to do for a realized character? What movement can I put here?
Well, and these 3 issues specifically, we see a huge movement forward for Zuko.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Jen?
So, I really liked what David said about Zuko getting what he deserves. I like that. And that makes me give this comic a 5. This was such a satisfying story if you've watched the cartoon. I think earlier in the episode I said that it answers all the questions I had in a really good way. Mm-hmm. And these were the things that kind of left me hanging at the end of Avatar, and I'm glad they've been addressed. And I'm glad they've been addressed so satisfyingly. It's nice to see something good happen to a character you like, even if they're fictional. It's like warm fuzzies. And I think that I prefer this over... Well, I rated it higher than The Promise, but I absolutely prefer it because I think that for this kind of thing where you're writing in 3 chapters in a limited amount of space, that telling character stories ends up being like more succinct, and you can do a better job of controlling, I guess, the themes and messages that you want to convey, showing a good amount of development and then, you know, creating a plot and resolving it. Whereas if you're trying to show something about the world, you're dealing with something really big and nebulous and it gets harder to contain. I feel like pacing wise, this story was really good. You know, it was never too fast. Like, I always knew what was happening, but it was always incredibly engaging. And I think a lot of that had to do with the subject matter. But yeah, I really love this. I will probably reread this later on just because it was fun, and I will recommend it to all my friends. So 5.
Nice. Well, I fucked that up.
Oh.
You guys want to do some trivia?
Trivia.
Mine's okay. Even related to Avatar.
Ooh, I'm going to go first.
David?
Your topic is Avatar The Last Airbender, The Search.
All right.
So you have 6 points. You're 5 behind Jen and considerably ahead of me.
All right. 6 points. Let's go. Man, I'm 5 behind Jen.
Yeah, and 5 is the max.
Man, I'm going to go 5. Let's do
okay.
it.
Okay. What was Zuko's half-sister's name? Was it Haru, Kiyi, Noriko, or Nyla?
It is Kiyi.
That is right for 5 points.
Yes.
Did you like just read it when you were flipping through?
I remember that. That stood out. That is actually something I remembered from
I was flipping through. I was like, holy shit, I completely forgot that kid's name. I would have easily gotten that one wrong. All right.
Jen?
Mine is a question about Avatar The Last Airbender. The answer to this question came out of the show, but it's like, yeah. Anyways, so Jen, your question is, about Jen, Avatar The Last Airbender, and it came out of the show. So.
Okay. Well, I always bet 5, so I'm going to bet 5.
Okay. So here's your question. Who is known as the Dragon of the West? Is it Zuko, Iroh, Azula, or Ozai?
Iroh.
That's correct.
Our questions about Avatar are not difficult enough, apparently.
No.
I give Jen free points last week. I give David free points this week.
Oh, well. This is not very compelling trivia for our listeners, but that's okay.
I don't know. We'll see. Depends on what Jen has for me.
Andy. Okay, so this is also about Avatar The Last Airbender.
5 points.
The Search. Okay. So, which of the following animals did not appear in the comic this week?
Shit.
A. The squirrel toad. B. The chicken pig. C. The buzzard wasp. Or D. The flutter bat.
Okay. Buzzard wasp did show. Chicken pig did show. What was the last one? Flutterbat?
Flutterbat.
Flutterbat was there. It's the first. I don't remember what the first one is, but it was that one.
Final answer?
Yes.
I am sorry.
No!
Squirtle Toad was in there. We actually saw Moth Wasp. The Buzzard Wasp is from the desert with the library.
I'm sorry. Somebody lost. Please. Sorry.
I'm not winning. There's no way I can possibly win this. Okay, let's get the scores.
Jen, 60. David, 11. Andy, negative, 7.
So, there's only one more week of trivia. Next week is the Rift. So, for next week, if Jen gets it right, David can't win. But if David bets 5 points, and Jen bets 5 points, and Jen loses... Well, if Jen bets 5 and loses, then she'll be at 11, which will tie David where you are right now. So, next week, if you get 1 point, David... And Jen gets her question wrong, assuming she sticks to her tactic of betting 5 all the time.
At this point, it's a matter of honor.
So, David, you have to hope she gets next week wrong, and you have to get next week right.
Well, she'll be asking me a question next week, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I will have you guys ask each other, and I will have a tiebreaker question teed up just in case.
Vicious.
Sounds good.
All right. Because I am, there's no possible way I'm in this. So, yeah, that's next week. Next week we are going to read The Rift by Jean Luen Yang. And this gets back to some Toph stuff. At least I think it does, because she's on the cover.
Yep. So, I just bought it from Dark Horse Digital. Yay. So I'm all ready to read it.
Sick. I just ordered it on Amazon, that library edition. They're so pretty.
Yeah, I got it on the app because it was just convenient, but I kind of wish I had bought the other little trades so I'll have the complete collection. Maybe I'll still do that. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. All right, that's next week. Until then, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye.
When a comic's good, it's harder to talk about.
But that one was good. We were able to articulate why we thought it was good.
Yeah, and well, I think...
Which was also good.
Like, I'm noticing that there are comics that, like, we'll say is good, and then it's hard to talk about, and there are comics that we'll say is good, and then we can just keep talking forever. And I think, like... I've noticed this about myself, getting more discerning. Like, I made the conscious decision to stop watching Game of Thrones. Because it is a well-made show with good acting and good production, but it's not a good story. I think it's a bad story.
Brent and I had this exact same discussion yesterday.
And so I think it tricks you into thinking it's a good show. I think it tricks you into it.
Right? Like, so because it's actually not well-paced and there's no character development.
No, it does. It tricks you into it. And I think we've read comics before that have tricked us because they've been well drawn and have writing like tropes or writing mechanics that we know are supposed to work and that we know are good. And it'll have all of these pieces that are right, but we'll rate it well, but then we just can't talk about it for some reason. I think the ones that we can't talk about like that, even though they're all right, I think those are those ones that are like, it's like the comic book equivalent of good production value, but not good show.
Yeah. You know?
And like this was legitimately a good comic.
We read a lot of like charismatic comics that are like, well, that was fun, but this was like Boxers and Saints, where we sat down and we had like philosophical discussions about big ideas in relation to characters.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it fun.
Yeah. So I mean, maybe what we can do is we can go back and we can reread some of those that we gave a 5 that we might not again. Maybe we can do that down the line.
That'd be interesting. I'd really be down for that, actually.
Because I've noticed, like, Jean Luen Yang is legitimately a good author, and J.M.D. Matthes, like, that Spider-Man one, Kraven's Last Hunt, just sticks in my head all the fucking time, and Walt Simonson. But then there's others that I know I gave a 5 that if I went back, I'd be like, well, it wasn't that good.
Yeah.
I could rewrite that much lower now.